Tonight I'd like to speak a bit about tools for the toolkit, as it were. As I was looking in a bookstore, I noticed that there's a lot. There are sections about pets and things, and they're all of the nature of the kind of general title of them is the care and feeding of, and then whatever the beast is. Care and feeding of parakeets, the care and feeding of guinea pigs, and so on. So it occurs to me that there would be a very useful thing to have a book on the care and feeding of the eagle eye. Because this is, as it were, the internal beast in us. I don't mean that in any negative way, like some devilish thing or not, but it's this thing that can get out of hand. And yet we commonly let it get out of hand, thinking that that's our function. So tools for the road in the practice of Zen involves the realization that the great sea of suffering in which we live, the great sea of dissatisfaction, is all caused by our own human mind, by the activity of this this ego eye, we call it, just a name. Nobody can find it. You can't surgically remove it, and you can't anatomically find it. It's just a name to correspond to certain functions and activities of mind. And the most common activity of human beings is the care and feeding of the ego eye in various ways. Totally not realizing that in this great sea of suffering, there arose something that is an actual cure for this whole activity that leads one to what the consummation of many people's efforts is, which is peace and a kind of equanimity and happiness, satisfaction, the absence of fear of death, things of that sort. None of which can be gotten through letting the beast run our minds. Please take the term beast as just a kind of semi-humorous way of speaking of it. So we need to understand that part of our practice is dealing with these inherent qualities of human beings. By that I mean that a human being, by nature, is distinct from other organisms. As far as we know, has the capacity for, we might say, consciousness. That means that we develop the capacity to construct a world, to speak of it and us, to move into the realm of naming everything. For example, there are many consequences of this capacity, but it's unique to human beings. It's a kind of a thing that's the mark of a human being. This what we call in our way of speaking of it, a division. That we are divided beings, and we divide the world. Our analysis, if we do it, will easily indicate to us that the world is not made up of disparate things, that everything is connected with everything else. And if we examine ourselves inside, it's not too hard to realize that there is no self there. There are all kinds of things that we call the self that are identifications with our roles and our activities and our ethnicities and all of those things, but really they are all limited and they are all transient and they are all made up. It's not that hard. But that doesn't do much. That is in the domain of people who specialize in describing things and making it into one more thing that can become a scholarly discipline. But it doesn't help us to release ourselves from the bondage to the beast. So, in the practice of Zen, we always speak of the necessity of clearing the mind, so that that which is possible for a human being, namely our inherent Buddha nature, our inherent quality of compassion and peace and wisdom, can be revealed to us and can become something that manifests in us ongoingly in our lives. And that that's stopped somehow by the fact that our consciousness, which would be the way by which we would know it, is filled with all kinds of stuff. All kinds of stuff is, what I'm saying here with some kind of tongue-in-cheek, the activity of the beast. So we've got to be street smart about this beast, about this ego eye inside. We've got to get real street smart about it. And we have to do intentional activity with regard to it in order that we take the steps necessary to be released from bondage to it. The bondage we often refer to as Velcro, things like that, in the way we talk. It's just the way we talk. Another way of looking at it is it's the vast ignorance that is fundamental to human beings. Ignorance of what is possible and ignorance of how to realize the possibility. Vast ignorance. So to help to dispel such ignorance, the practice of Zen requires to have certain tools in the toolkit. Now, of course, the fundamental one for all us practitioners of Zen is the witnessing. When things come into the mind, we merely witness them. We let them be. We in no way confer reality upon them by fighting them or by inviting them in or by elaborating them. As best we can, we simply let them be. As being mere phenomena, no bad, no good, just what the series of causes and conditions brought into conscious manifestation at that moment. That's all. So far, so good. So some things have more Velcro on them. Some tendencies have more Velcro. And so it's useful to have certain additional tools. You all know, have heard me quote that wonderful Kurt Vonnegut piece of doggerel. Tigers have to bite, birds have to fly, human beings have to ask why. Tigers have to sleep, birds have to land, human beings have to understand. That is a very important part of this, the activity of the beast. The distinction that we have to make as intelligent practitioners of Zen is that there is a certain number of these things that are worthy of understanding in each individual person's world. They relate specifically to whatever one's specific life circumstances are. It's good to be able to explain them, because then one can maybe do something about them. If you know something about the noises that a car makes when its carburetor is going to give out pretty soon, then it's useful to be able to correlate those and go to some place that will repair your carburetor. Various kinds of functioning of this mind are very important in our activity in the world, our karmic life. However, what happens is that this capability of generating maps in the mind, structures of knowledge, we call them explanations or stories and whatever, takes over very often, and everything has to be explained. We just can't let it be. we do what Kurt Vonnegut says. We have to ask why? So it's very useful in terms of moving along the path of Zen, that is to say, the path of clearing the mind so that one can realize, that is to say, make real in one's life what is possible for one because it is one's inherent nature. So it's important then to distinguish, do I really have to explain that? Is it really necessary that I know the name of that? And so on. Now, if you're learning a language and you want to become adept at it, to be able to speak it and utilize it, then it is important to learn those names and so on. But you can do that without being attached to that that compulsion to have to name everything and to have to explain everything. When we had our residential Zen center in New York State, as many of you know, I used to give people what I call training phrases. And one of the training phrases was, this has no meaning and I don't need to understand it. And the instruction was to take that phrase for a day, and no matter what you're doing, no matter what the mind comes up, it was just, oh, well, what's that all about? Oh, this has no meaning and I don't need to understand it. Someone, you're driving down the road and the car ahead of you, somebody throws a beer can out the window, and instead of going, well, what's going on? Why don't they realize this is my living room? And they say, oh, this has no meaning and I don't need to understand it. To catch this mind running itself automatically, like the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Just going wild, this beast. So it's very useful to be able to distinguish those things. This is what we're asking, is to raise one's level of awareness and to utilize this tool as a process of raising one's level of awareness, to be clear about what needs an explanation and what does not. If you see a particular item that is colored in a certain way, and do you really need to know what the name of that color is? Do you need to bother your mind with its automatic activities? Well, that's kind of like, but it's not really like that. It's kind of like, do you really have to do that? Is that serving anything? If you're an interior decorator, it might be. If you're not, let it be. You can appreciate it, but you don't have to name it. You don't have to explain it. I wonder how they make that pigment. If you're a painter, if you're someone who uses pigments, that might be a useful question. But if you're not, let it be. One of the things that people don't like to say to themselves or to others is, I don't know. And yet we point out in Zen often that this phrase, I don't know, is a profound threshold for wisdom. It's a threshold of becoming very intimate and close with the world without erecting something between you and the world that you're experiencing, called an explanation or a name or an association of any kind. This is the activity of what I'm humorously calling the beast. So, that's one important tool in the toolkit. You might answer if someone says, why do you want to know that? Well, I'm just interested. This is a nonsense remark. Interested for what? How does it contribute to you or the world? Is it just a way that you enhance your ego by being able to speak about it, being able to say something other than I don't know? Maybe it is. Look at that. The care and feeding of the ego eye. Many people, most people, almost all people, are engaged in the care and feeding of the ego eye. They do it in automatic ways. They think of all kinds of things that make them unique. distinctive. And yet, on the other hand, they're looking at certain ways in which they can be part of a chosen tribe. Wearing the right clothing, saying that things in the right way, living in the right neighborhood, in the right house, having the right kind of car. On it goes. Which, if you examine underneath and underneath and underneath, they are in order to be a member of a certain tribe, to be identified as a certain class, and thus care and feed this scared ego that wants the protection, as it did in ancient times, to belong to a tribe. Watch the mind. Is that what it's doing? The response that most people have to something that they encounter or that someone is speaking to them about is to refer to themselves. So the immediate thing is, well, I wouldn't do that. Or I know what that's like because I've been there. Or they'll do something, but it's referring to the self. What's really underneath all that? What kind of care and feeding of the ego eye is that about? Is it valuable? Is it useful? Does it give you any knowledge? Or are you just generalizing? Because, to be honest, you don't know why that person said or did what they did or said. You act as though you do. You say, I've been there. I know what that's like, and so on. But that's really not true, is it? Because you have not really been in the world of that person. So to say that is just another way of enhancing yourself and saying, oh, I know that. I had a client once. He was the youngest in his Italian family, and his older brothers, who were born in Italy and then moved to this country, he told me that he would ask them questions as a young kid. He would ask for explanations, or why do you say that, or why? And they would also say that they would very often say to him, you should know that. They wouldn't answer him beyond that. You should know that. Which was, of course, very unhelpful for the poor little kid. People don't want to admit that they don't quite know it. Oh, I know it. I know that. I know that. What does that do? What's it all about? I'm not stupid. I'm not ignorant. I'm a knowledgeable member of the tribe. Whatever it is, care and feeding of the ego eye. Versus inquire. Say, I don't know. Or inquire. Or even say, I think it's like that, but I'm not sure because I haven't had your experience. Will you tell me a little bit more about what it was like for you? You'll learn. Everyone represents their facet of this great human being. The care and feeding of the ego eye. There's a couple of precepts in our 10 bodhisattvic precepts that relate especially to this. Number 6, for example, is called the precept to avoid gossiping about the misdeeds of others. Isn't that fascinating that we folks have a precept? You don't find that in the Ten Commandments, for example. You don't find anything like that in such prescriptions of behavior in the Judeo-Christian tradition. But we have that here, the 6th precept, the precept against gossiping about the misdeeds of others. Bodhidharma, as a verse that is attached in our version of the precepts, and his verse goes as follows. Self-nature is clear and obvious. In the realm of the errorless Dharma, not speaking of the misdeeds of others, or rather, not speaking erroneously. That's how it goes. Not speaking erroneously is the precept to refrain from speaking of the misdeeds of others. And that gives the great key to it. A key to something that we have mentioned so many times, but has to be a part of the investigative tool as you're doing your zazen, the actual sitting down practice of zazen, dealing with the things that course through the field of consciousness. And that is that things could not have been otherwise. Everyone that you see could not have been otherwise. I was somewhere the other day, and it wasn't about a misdeed, but it was about that, about a physical characteristic of a person. And someone said, she has elephant legs. And of course, she wasn't like a pachyderm. There weren't those characteristics of her legs, but maybe they were larger than other people's legs. The person who said it had very slender legs. But what's that about? Where did that come from? And why would it be said? Is it the business of folks to classify legs? Is that of use to anybody? It might be. There maybe there's some medical or sociological specialties to which it would be relevant, but basically it's just a comment that is like gossiping about the qualities of others. Let's change it a little bit. Gossiping. Like, so what? That person, as we know, had the physical characteristics that were inevitable, given the course of life that that person had lived. They were inevitable. And they weren't bad or good. They just were what they were, and they couldn't have been otherwise. To speak of it in any other way is to think that there was some error, some mistake, some deviation from something that could have been. And yet, when we think about it, it's only that the person who made those remarks has some image in their minds of some kind of ideal or how things ought to be, and there was a deviation in her mind in the physical build of that person that made her make that kind of a comment. What's underneath it? Probably something like, therefore I'm superior. If a person makes a comment about another person in a complimentary way, for example, I just think what he did in that circumstance was just really, really, really wonderful. Or I really, what you said was really helpful for me. That was really, really great. Thank you. Is that gossiping about the misdeeds of others, or does it have another basis? A basis of perhaps inspiration, a basis of opening the mind a bit to something that wasn't realized before, something, but it's not the function that is served by gossiping about the misdeeds of others, all of which has some reference to a self and establishes in the mind of the person who says it some kind of a superiority. And an ignorance of the fundamental presupposition that things could not have been otherwise, which is easy to demonstrate if you analyze your own life. To speak of misdeed is a thing that we say after the fact. But at the moment in which whatever was done occurred, it was the only thing possible at that moment. Therefore, there is no mistake, except in our foolish analysis afterwards. And that analysis might be useful under some circumstances. If, for example, you are running some kind of a campaign, either a military campaign or an advertising campaign or some kind of a campaign, and you are taking feedback about what was done last week or something in the campaign, and you say, oh, that was a mistake. So what you're really saying was, it's not that it could have been done otherwise at the moment, but the outcome was not something that we had realized. And in order to correct that and get closer to the outcome that we wanted, we have to do something differently. We call it sloppily a mistake, but it was not a mistake. It couldn't have been otherwise. Those kinds of things, they need to be analyzed carefully because they intrude into our mind and they have Velcro attached to them because the culture supports thinking in that way. And that to the degree that we allow that to take root in our minds is a degree to which we are barring ourselves from the realization of the world that is possible for us to know. We're substituting instead some kind of a story, something that we made up, that had as its basis no evidence at all from the other person or from anything else. It's purely self-generated. And then sometimes the beast goes on by itself and invents all kinds of stories to scare the shit out of ourselves and whatever, or to give us glory. Stories that give us glory and so on, and obviously care and feeding of the ego eye. This supports our glorious self or whatever it may be doing. This supports the idea that we're some kind of despicable being or whatever it is. But it's all about the care and feeding of the ego eye. This has to be realized before we give way to it. But in the process of it happening, our arms have to embrace it, because that too, that comment, that criticism of self or other could not have been otherwise. It arose as a result of causes and conditions in our field of consciousness at that moment, because it could not have otherwise. So it has to be embraced. We have not to denigrate ourselves, punish ourselves, say bad things about ourselves, or do anything like that, but just to use it as an opportunity to wake up a little bit more. Now, the next precept is also very relevant to this process of having tools to help us to release ourselves from the activity of this ego eye in our minds. So this is number 7. And number 7 goes like this. It's the precept about not extolling ourselves and downgrading others. And Bodhidharma says in his verse, self-nature is clear and obvious in the realm of the equal Dharma. Not making a distinction between oneself and others is to uphold the precept of not extolling ourselves and downgrading others. The equal Dharma. Now, this is a peculiar idea for many people, given the disparity and the multiplicity of people and lives and activities and trees and grasses and whatever in the world, to speak of the equal Dharma. We could point out that the same tendencies exist, the nature of human being to have this story-building capacity, this generalizing capacity, this map-making capacity, is based upon the same structural rules that in everybody. There is generalization, there is deletion or selection. We select certain things to string together in our stories and we neglect other things. People, for example, in making the story of their lives, say, well, let me tell me about my life or what's your life story. They won't mention how they brush their teeth. That's irrelevant to them. Where they buy their groceries, things like that. Those are activities they do. They're as much a function of their life as certain other things, but they select and delete other ones and select other ones to string them together. We do that in making our stories. We generalize, we delete or select, and we distort. It wasn't really like that. What it really was like, what I really meant to say was about what it really was. And so we distort according to our convenience in having whatever piece of data that we are thinking about be in accord with the story that we're building, and that may be okay, as we say, for government work in certain things. It might help you to navigate through the world in certain areas, which is the function of these maps at their best. But it may also simply be a gratuitous activity of the beast. And everyone has their own style of being plagued by their own demons. That is to say, by these recurrent stories or recurrent thought patterns in the mind. And they have to be recognized for what they are, that they couldn't have been otherwise. And they too, in some magnificent way that ultimately everybody will realize, manifest Buddha nature. And yet at this point, they are, because of their automaticity, because they are allowed to take root, they obstruct the mind from realizing what is possible for it. So in the equal Dharma, that's certainly one thing. We all have common characteristics of things that we do. And so to extol oneself and downgrade others is, you have to do a lot of searching to figure out things that will justify extolling oneself over others. But even making that distinction is a thing that contaminates the nature of the world. Things are what they are. Period. They are what they are. They are not great. They are not small. They are not bad. They are not good. They are what they are. All attributions of glory and fame are purely the result of stories in our minds and the selection process that lets us designate certain things as being glorious and certain things as being despicable or unworthy and so on. It's all just part of our story-building apparatus, and one needs only to look at certain areas in the world these days where it's held to be a good thing to do dishonorable and horrible things to folks that are called your enemies. And so one needs to look into that. See the total arbitrariness of extolling oneself and downgrading others. If it's about some kind of accomplishment or lack of accomplishment in someone else, could you have done anything differently? No. Could they have done anything differently? No. It's just as the strange kind of popular way of putting it has it, it's the way the cookie crumbles. It's just what is. Just what is. Some folks do things that are extolled by the world, and some things are done by people that are ignored by the world, or considered to be mundane, or considered to be nothing. And yet there are many things that are considered to be nothing that are, without them, the world would be a very sorry place. The ways in which, for example, hard-working parents devote a lot of their time to taking good care of their children with the intention that they will become good citizens of the world, and so on. It doesn't go noticed, doesn't go as a place where anything is extolled. And yet, far more valuable perhaps in the evolution of the planet than folks who have conquered something or done some kind of thing that some story considers to be glorious, and so on, and so on, and so on. So, this precept is a very important one, one that helps us to be more mindful, helps us to carry on our practice. Now, it's really important, as we always say about the precepts, these never should be used as rules. They are not rules. We have no rules. We are not based upon you or any other, or anyone else conforming to some kind of expectation or some kind of a map or desired state. Everyone, remember, manifests Buddha nature totally and completely, whether that is realized by the observer or not. It is the fact. So it's a really important thing to let the world be. Cherish it. Appreciate it. As it says in the first precept, the precept about not killing. It speaks of cherishing all life. Cherishing all life. This doesn't mean you have to hug trees and all those silly things that people talk about. But it means that you look at it and you see it as the unique manifestation of unique causes and conditions in that unique island of time and space that it is, or that she is or he is. And spend time being with it. I try as best I can when I say to someone, how are you? I'm not speaking as just a conventional way of greeting. Because if I weren't really interested by having some little signal that maybe something has passed over the face of that person, or maybe I hear something about their life and so on, I just want to hear how that grew or developed or whatever. All in a matter of learning and knowing about the person, so they may be even more cherished. If I didn't have that intention, I would, as I often do, I say hi. That everything that we say, everything that we do, is not a throwaway. We have a unique and marvelous opportunity in this lifetime where everything counts. Everything. The way in which we open and close doors, it counts. Counts to whom? It counts to the process of our unveiling our illusion-enshrouded mind, so that what is possible for us may more and more become manifest and be something from which we can learn more and more to live. So that's why I'm speaking about the care and feeding of the ego eye, the very common, probably the most common activity that people do, the care and feeding of the ego eye. And what we as practitioners of Zen, with our really cherishing the possibilities of our life, need to do in the field that is so filled with the various forms of the care and feeding of the ego eye. Remember, it's not a rule, not something you should do. But to have that intention to make real in your life what is possible and value this enormously, this enormously precious and unique opportunity that life is. Though we'll end there tonight.